From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The naturalist and writer Diane Ackerman hadn't gone to Poland looking for the story she tells in her 2007 book, but one thing led to another, and she stumbled upon Antonina and Jan Żabiński, a zookeeper and his wife. The Żabińskis ran the Warsaw Zoo in the days of the German occupation, and they were able to give refuge to more than 300 Jews right under the nose of the Nazis. They survived by taking these lessons from the animals that surrounded them. And like all of her work, Ackerman finds a connection between animal and human nature that helps her explain our capacity for compassion and evil. Her book is now a film. It's screening in Salt Lake City this week. So today we're rebroadcasting our conversation with Diane Ackerman about The Zookeeper's Wife after the news.
Love what you hear? Radio West podcast is made possible in part by thousands of KUER sustainers, along with Albion Financial Group, wealth advisors since 1982. Albion values local organizations helping to enrich the community through the power of ideas. Find out more online at albionfinancial.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Once you hear the story of Jan and Antonina Żabiński, you'll be amazed that for decades it remained untold. Diane Ackerman, the acclaimed naturalist and writer, says the story had fallen between the seams of history. She says lots of radically compassionate acts do. The Żabińskis ran the Warsaw Zoo in those horrific years of World War II when German troops stormed into Poland, determined to annihilate Polish society, Polish culture, and the Polish Jews. Jan and Antonina were Christians who had a deep affection for the animals they cared for. In fact, this relationship helped them make sense of the brutality around them. It also provided the circumstance to save more than 300 people destined to be killed by the Nazis. Diane Ackerman's book is called The Zookeeper's Wife. It's been made into a film that's opening this week in Salt Lake City, which is giving us an opportunity to rebroadcast our conversation with her. Ackerman says it was sense impressions, as she calls them, that helped her recreate the story of Jan and Antonina from diaries and letters and photos. It's how she met them, she says, though they had been dead for years.
I love taking off myself like a second sweater and insinuating myself into the sensibility of someone else or another animal. I've written about endangered animals a lot and tried to see the world from their perspective. And part of what drew me to Antonina is that that's exactly what she did. Mm-hmm. She wrote a series of children's books in which she viewed the world from the perspective of whatever animal she was writing about. She had enormous powers of empathy and compassion. It was part of her greatest gift, and I felt very, very close to her.
She called that bond that she had with animals everlasting.
Everlasting. Her husband, who prided himself on being cynical and a hard-nosed realist, thought it was almost mystical, a very magical relationship with animals, and he credited her with a kind of telepathy with both, humans and the other animals we call animals. And said that whenever there was an ornery animal at the zoo, he would always put it in her keeping and she could calm it.
Do you think that one thing that I was surprised about was the constant connection with animals in the characters and in the people of this book, the people of Eastern Europe, the Poles, for example, the animals that you see constantly in their folk tales, that there was a conservation movement in Poland that was quite strong, even surprising that the Nazis themselves had an ardent love for animals.
I think people really don't understand how contradictory the Nazis were when it came to nature.
Yeah.
They were extremely green. They led the world of their time in environmentalism. They passed many animal rights laws as they were rising to power. It was perfectly okay to operate on inmates of Auschwitz without anesthesia, but when a well-known biologist performed experiments on worms, he was punished for not giving them enough anesthesia. So they, on the one hand, were terrified of the idea of pests and lice. And as long as they put all of the Slavs, so that included Jews, Catholics, oh, heaven knows, many people, millions and millions of people, sure, into the category of pests, then they could be done away with. But on the other hand, they found animals mythic, holy, angelic, and very much part of a kind of Nordic mythology that they believed that they sprang from. According to the mystical cults that Nazism really came out of, they had all descended from the people of Atlantis. And when Atlantis sank, the survivors spread all over the world and, of course, became the royalty in different cultures. And this was believed so wholeheartedly that Himmler sent out expeditions to Tibet and the Amazon and other places to find the remnants of those people from Atlantis, because they were hoping to breed back to the pure Aryan form. Well, that was also true with animals. And a lot is known about their experiments in breeding humans.
Yeah.
But very few people realize that it did not stop there. Their plan was to dominate the plants and the animals of the entire planet.
Change the whole ecosystem.
The whole evolution.
Wow.
That's why, part of why it was so horrifying. There have been many genocides in the past. But what was different about Nazism is that it wanted to tamper with evolution itself. Now, to some extent, that's always true. I mean, it's true throughout the animal kingdom, and we don't appreciate that. We see genocide happening now, and it's horrible. But we don't realize that lions do this too. Other animals do this too. Typically, what happens is that a male lion will invade a pride and kill all of the males, kill all of the offspring, and then mate with the females so that only that lion's genes will continue into the next generations. Well, the Nazis planned on doing that worldwide, and they planned on changing the climate. They planned on draining 100,000 acres of Polish marshes, which would certainly have ruined the ecosystem and a lot of the native plants and animals. But that didn't bother them because they wanted to get rid of the Polish farmers, actually Russians too, all of the Slavs.
Sure.
Replace them with Germans and tear up the so-called Slavic or Jewish crops and replace them with pure Aryan crops. And part of the way they were going to achieve this was that they had a botanical commando unit, which was literally called that in German, and commandos because they were sent all over the world to break into botanical gardens and steal the most valuable seeds and bring them home for breeding.
So this is the context in which this story is told then, the
zookeeper.
Yes. And his wife. So it's about the animals. It's interesting. It's the theme throughout the book in terms of human nature and animal nature.
Yes.
And Tanina and Jan trying to make sense of the brutality they're seeing through, you know, animal behavior or understanding.
Yes.
That in some ways. That's the connection there.
That was their training.
Yeah.
And it served them well, because when various Nazis came to the door, and that happened way too often and very dangerously, they used their cleverness in observing animals, which they applied to the people they were dealing with, and also for the people they were hiding. Who better than zookeepers to understand camouflage?
Mm.
They knew perfectly well how to do that. The Jabinskis were able to capitalize on this paradox that the Nazis were displaying and use it to their advantage to save the lives of over 300 people who were doomed. But all but two survived,
yeah,
and those two only died of illness. the Jabinskis really ran one of the most successful hideouts of World War II.
Jan talks about understanding all the fineries of animal courtship, understanding bluff and understanding threat.
Yes.
Understanding appeasement gestures.
Yes.
From animals. And he used these.
Oh, yes.
In the way he negotiated with the Nazis.
Absolutely. And there are various scenes in the book where you see him using exactly these kinds of techniques.
It's wild.
It is wild. He knew what to do because he appreciated that humans have a very powerful, not very often recognized, animal nature that we abide by. The thing that we too infrequently credit is that our animal nature includes compassion. And I see their story as a story of radical acts of compassion, subversive compassion. That's what they were up to.
I want to ask about Antonina's connection with animals. You talked about that bond. And there's a section in the book I wanted to have you read, if you would, where she, as you write, slips out of her human skin for a while. And she has this belief, and maybe you could talk about this before you read it, but that she says people obviously, I guess maybe that is not so obvious to some, but need to connect more with their animal nature. But she used to think that animals wanted to reach out for humans as well.
Well, there is an interconnectedness of all life on Earth, not just psychologically from our perspective, but in the electromagnetic energy that emanates from all creatures, in these basic desires. I once studied squirrels at the same time that I was volunteering for suicide prevention.
Wow.
And I discovered that the humans calling in on the crisis line and the squirrels when they were in crisis, really they all had the same predicaments. And I think that humans and animals both appreciate this. Many people have pets who recognize when they are unhappy. If you whimper around your pet dog or cat, it will come over and nuzzle you. Yes, there are is an infinite and very subtle line of connectedness. Antonina identified with animals, fascinated by how their senses tested the world. She and Jan soon learned to slow around predators like wildcats because close-set eyes give them pinpoint depth perception, and they tend to get excited by quick movements a leap or two away. Prey animals like horses and deer enjoy wraparound vision to spot predators creeping up on them, but panic easily. The lame speckled eagle tethered in their basement was essentially a pair of binoculars with wings. The hyena pups would have spotted Antonina coming in total darkness. Other animals could sense her approach, taste her scent, hear the faintest swoosh of her robe, feel the weight of her footsteps vibrating the floorboards a whisker's worth, even detect the motes of air she pushed aside. She envied their array of ancient, finely tuned senses, a human gifted with those ordinary talents Westerners would call a sorcerer. Antonina loved to slip out of her human skin for a while and spy on the world through each animal's eyes, and she often wrote from that outlook, in which she intuited their concerns and know-how, including what they might be sensing, feeling, fearing, remembering. When she entered their ken, a transmigration of sensibility occurred, and like the lynx kittens she hand-raised, she could peer up at a world of loud, dangling beings. And then she wrote in her diary, "With legs little or large, walking in soft slippers or solid shoes, quiet or loud, with the mild smell of fabric or the strong smell of shoe polish. The soft fabric slippers moved quietly and gently. They didn't hit the furniture, and it was safe to be around them. Calling kichi, kichi, until a head with fluffy blonde hair would appear, and a pair of eyes behind large glass lenses would bend over. It didn't take long to realize that the soft fabric slippers, the blonde fluffy head, and the high-pitched voice were all the same object."
Diane Ackerman. Her book is called The Zookeeper's Wife. It's the basis for a film opening at various places in Salt Lake City this week. For details and showtimes, go to our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with the writer and naturalist Diane Ackerman, talking about the story she uncovered of Jan and Antonina Jabinski, a zookeeper, and his wife. The couple ran the Warsaw Zoo during the brutal Nazi occupation of World War II, and they were able to resist. Even more, they performed radically compassionate acts. In fact, there at their zoo, they were able to save more than 300 people destined to be exterminated by the Nazis. Her book is called The Zookeeper's Wife. It's the basis of a new film opening in Salt Lake City. We'll give you details about that as we go along. Ackerman joined us to talk about the role of nature in kindness and savagery. You know, it's interesting. I've heard there are these flashes of images that I catch in the book that sort of I pay particular attention to. One is this moment during the occupation where that sort of bright color of borscht. It's one of the images that you bring. And there's another one that I think is really memorable, and it's that image of feathers floating in the air.
Oh, yes.
Talk about that.
Yes, when Warsaw was bombed, of course, everything was on fire and exploded. Horses were killed in the street. The stench must have been unholy. But something else happened. The bombs also blew up beds and bedding, and so observers said that when they walked outside, the air was full of feathers. What an extraordinary thing to have feathers raining down on you. And I thought that it probably reminded the citizens of Warsaw of one of the great tales of their nights, which was that when they were being invaded, they attached feather wings to their armor, and when they rode into battle, the wind coursing through the feathers made such a catastrophic sound that it frightened the enemy's horses.
They wouldn't charge.
And so they wouldn't charge. They were terrified by this weird whirring sound. But now picture these feathers raining down on the citizens. Must have been as if those knights had been slaughtered.
There's a you talk about how you came to this story in a very personal way. You almost stumbled upon it, and you weren't looking for the Jabinski.
No, I really wasn't. And this is an unknown story of World War II, and also unknown in Poland.
Wow.
It's just fallen between the seams of history.
Isn't that funny? It's because the zoo was such a central part. And Jan even describes it, the zoo as part of the Polish identity.
It was part of the Polish identity. But remember, after the war, the Russians invaded. And then it was not at all popular to have been in the resistance.
Yeah.
And so everything got quieted down and kind of stored on the shelf. When the book comes out in Poland, there are going to be events at the zoo, and there'll be a lot of events for children especially to teach them what took place during the resistance, the central role that the zoo played, that it was, yes, a role of great physical heroism. There was a lot of violence, a lot of combat involved, but most of all, it was a role of compassion. It's one thing for the Jews to be heroic and risking their lives. They had to. But when the Polish Catholics did, that was something else. They didn't have to. They could have just been mum and protected their families. So for rescuers who were Catholic to go out and risk their lives to this extent was really something.
You said it was sort of part of the had been throughout history part of sort of the Polish psyche offering refuge to the Jews. I mean, there's
yes.
I think the Yiddish word pull in.
Meant rest here.
Rest here.
So, of course, it was fate.
Yes. Yeah.
They had to come. There, I think, was 1.3 million people in Warsaw, and a third of them were Jewish, because Poland had very wisely, for many reasons, artistically, economically, lots of reasons, offered refuge to the Jews. One of the things that the Jews brought with them was the ability to dye silk red and many other things. So it made sense, and certainly there was anti-Semitism still going on,
sure.
But it took tens of thousands of people to secure the life of even one hideaway during the war. So when you think about it, at any one time, 60,000, 70,000 people in Warsaw were actively risking their lives. Of course, Poland had the strongest resistance of anybody in Europe, and they were even praised by the Nazis. It was extremely well organized, and it was organized not just obsessively and well, but with good humor. Mm. The zoo had the code name of the house under a crazy star, because there were animals being raised indoors, being given human names, and there were humans hiding indoors being given animal names. And at any one time, there were 50 refugees hidden there. But inside the same house with the refugees, there was a predatory attack rabbit. There was a drunken hamster. There was a badger who was using their son's training potty. there was a cat who would get pregnant all the time. And the minute that she gave birth, her kittens were taken away from her and replaced with newborn foxes, which would confuse her because, you know, they barked. So it was a really crazy house, and they called it the house under a crazy star. And Jan's code name was Francis, for Francis of Assisi, patron saint of animals. Yeah.
And Antonina didn't even know the extent to which he had played in the resistance. She didn't understand, for example, the roles he was the things that he was hiding. For example, there on the he was trying to protect her. I guess
he was trying to protect her, and he said that quite rightly she would never have risked her son,
sure,
if she knew just how dangerous things were. He was willing to, for the greater good. But she didn't know that he was the head of a sabotage cell that specialized in bombing trains, that he was hiding explosives just a few yards away from their house, that in a little Nestle's tin can in the kitchen, which he told her, please just leave there. You know, it has the little screws and nails and things I need. That actually he had the fixings for fuses for bombs, and so on.
I wanted to ask you about the connection you had to Antonina. I wonder, did you connect to her right away, or what was the moment when you found that kind of that bond, that connection?
Well, you asked me earlier how I came by this story,
yeah,
and that's really connected. I first became interested in the story through the animals. I had heard 20 years ago that there were very ancient animals running around a primeval forest in Poland, and that these were the animals that cavemen had painted on the walls in ochre at Lascaux, where I had been and seen these walls and had been powerfully moved by the hunting magic. And I wondered, how did they get there? And National Geographic decided instead to send me to the South Pacific to write about something. But I stayed interested in these horses. And one thing led to another. I soon found that actually the horses and the bison were there because of a German zoologist. And then it turned out that he had them there because of the Warsaw Zoo. And then it turned out that they were involved because they had tricked him. And then it turned out that they had tricked him because they were hiding people. Mm. And then I found Antonina's diary, which had not been translated, and all kinds of other untranslated things. Now, I say I found them, but it took years to unearth them and to get them translated. Some of the writings were in Yiddish and Hebrew. There were interviews. It was very hard to find the son, actually. And he provided me with different archives and things like that, too. So then I began to find out more about Antonina, and I had translated a couple of her children's books. The minute that I began reading the way in which she drew no line between humans and animals, the way that she would just insinuate herself straight in to some other animal, the love, the profound love that she had for animals whom she regarded as alter egos and spoke openly about as cousins, neighbors. And it was not that she felt less love for humans. It wasn't that at all. She loved all creatures on the planet. She was Catholic. I believe she was religious. She doesn't write about that. Mm. But she does mention wearing a medallion. And I think if she wore a medallion well into her 30s, she was religious. And she carried that reverence for life to all things. Also, one of the most fascinating things about her was not that she wanted people to survive. She wanted them to survive with dignity, with sanity, with humor, with joy.
That was a big one.
It was with joy. That was extremely important to her.
I mean, despite all that's going on around, there at the villa, at the zoo, she sort of was intent on providing some measure of joy.
They had an actually festive relationship with each other, everybody. Their existence was good-humored. They knew what was going on around them. They heard every single day, and they discussed it, and they were worried. But everybody was worried. But they had piano concerts every night. They had a sculptress there. They had artwork. They had jokes. They had animals. They had the innocence of pets and children around them, too. And that was extremely important for her because there was no way to survive as a human being without joy. While this was going on, I discovered that in the ghetto, the Hasidic rabbi was leading his flock in meditating on the beauty of nature to survive. And the head of the orphanage in the ghetto was leading the children to do mindful chores. This was all very Buddhist when you think about it. It was the mindfulness of everyday life. You mentioned the beauty of the borscht, that sparkling red that would sit on the silver spoons and reflect light at the same time that there was the red of bloodshed taking place elsewhere and elsewhen in the city. This mindfulness, they understood instinctively, was their only hope. How does – really, the book asks the question – though it doesn't phrase it like this, how do you survive in a mutilated world?
Yeah.
And this was the way that they found, all of these people found separately to survive.
You know, it's interesting that there was a, there's a kind of a connection that I drew between these animals, these sort of exotic animals and, you know, animals on the sort of brink of extinction and the fact that you lay out in the book that while 30 to 40% of the world's Jews were killed during the war, what most people don't realize is that 80 to 90% of the Orthodox community.
That's
perished.
Right. The ones who specialized in the mysticism.
Yeah. So here's another extinction sort of going on that
yes.
you sort of deal with. And the rabbi, is it Shapira?
Yeah, it is.
His hidden sermons and his hidden diary that you talk about reveal what you call a tigerish struggle with faith.
What are you going to do if what you practice is a religion that celebrates life, a religion of joy and dancing and singing, when you are faced with the horrors and degradations taking place all around you? How does that fit? And so it was. It's not that he was perfect. None of these people were perfect by any means. They had to find a way to survive, to transcend. And they did in the most positive and optimistic ways, in the most beautiful ways.
Do you think that, you know, you hear from time to time people sort of confused about what are we supposed to call Diane Ackerman? Is she a poet? Does she do essays? Is she a naturalist? Have you settled on something?
People never do know how to introduce me. You're quite right, because my muse is very miscellaneous, so it's kind of hard to do.
Right.
Well, I am an earth ecstatic.
Hmm. This is your religion, as it were.
This is my private religion. Yeah. I'm the only one who belongs to this private church, although sometimes I would tease that my religion is our sisters of perpetual motion, or that I'm a 7-day opportunist, or, you know, whatever.
right.
But an earth ecstatic, yes. And my creed is very simple. I believe in the sanctity of life and the perfectibility of people. I think that people can improve the way they act towards one another. This is a very simple creed. But if you think about it, it includes everything. And it includes all of life on Earth and extends to the farthest star. I don't want people to part with spirituality just because they may not believe in a God, especially children. I don't want children to be praying to someone else's God in schools, for example, but I do want them to be spiritual. It's unfortunate that we make people choose when there is an interrelatedness, as I was saying, of all living things, and a kind of smallness which we all experience in the face of forces that are larger and older than we are. And again, I'm not personifying those forces. We can call it nature.
You said about yourself that you spend your life at age 11.
Yes, I am only an 11-year-old, really.
So, and this idea that you're trying to create your own sense of astonishment, so discovery and astonishment, surprise, seems to me what you're about. So do you – you must be a really intent observer. Are you constantly paying attention to the minutiae around you?
Well, in all fairness – yes. However, I was born like this. For example, it's normal for me to lie in my bay window at dawn, because I love to watch nature at dawn, as I was doing not too long ago. And I happened to look outside, and there was a bee sleeping on a leaf nearby. And it had golden pockets. You know, it had been collecting nectar. And it was clearly asleep. And I wondered why it hadn't gotten home to its hive. And I watched it a little bit longer, and it was just starting to wake up, and it moved its legs in one of those little hokey pokey kind of motion things, you know. And then it shivered to kind of get its body heat up, you know. And then it woke up and it stretched just like a human would stretch, except it was a bee. And it flew off. And I was so wonderstruck. In those moments, I would not have had the universe be anything that it wasn't. That's a perfect example of what we're talking about the rabbi, about Antonina. If you pay attention mindfully, if you are willing to get outside of yourself in some absorbing errand, like giving yourself over to the beauty of what is around you, Even if you are surrounded by horror, even in the midst of horror, nature can still offer amazing beauties. And there are people alive today all over the world now. This is what happened to Antonina is not just historic. In Darfur, any place that you look, I'm sure that there are people performing acts of mercy and heroism that don't involve shooting people and killing people, that involve salvation of the inner sort. And it's something that we can do personally every day of our lives. It's just a question of making room for it. I wake up every day startled to be alive, every single day. I was swimming the other day, and I looked up at the sky, and this is something I do quite often. And I just looked up and thought, oh, my God, I'm on a planet. I'm on a planet in space. And the trees are green on this planet. They don't have to be green. On some other planets, they could be red. They could be blue. It just happens that that's the way life evolved here. How miraculous. How strange. How wondrous.
Diane Ackerman. Her book is The Zookeeper's Wife, which is the basis of a new film opening Friday at the Broadway Center Cinemas in Salt Lake City. For showtimes there and other theaters around the valley where it's playing, you can visit radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the writer Diane Ackerman, talking about the story she uncovered of Jan and Antonina Jabinski. Her book is called The Zookeeper's Wife. It's now the basis for a new film, which is opening this week in Salt Lake City. We'll give you more details about that a little bit later in the program. I want to ask you about... You've already been influenced by Polish culture, your maternal grandparents... And there's this great circus folk story that you found early on, I guess, in this exploration that you found sort of oddly relevant. The story about the Jewish man who doesn't have any money and they ask him to dress up like a lion.
Yes. Would you like me to,
sure.
to read that?
Sure, that'd be great. It's such a great story.
It's a great story. My grandfather told wonderful stories from Poland, and one of them is of a village with a little circus whose lion had suddenly died. The circus director asked a poor old Jewish man if he would pretend to be the lion, and the man agreed since he needed the money. The director said, "All you have to do is wear the lion's fur and sit in the cage, and people will believe you're a lion." And so the man did, muttering to himself, "What strange jobs I've had in my life." When his thoughts were interrupted by a noise, he turned just in time to see another lion creeping into his cage and fixing him with a hungry stare. Trembling, cowering, not knowing how to save himself, the man did the only thing he could think of, vociferously chant a Hebrew prayer. No sooner had he uttered the first desperate words, Shema Yisrael, Hear, O Israel, than the other lion joined in with Adonai Eloheinu, the Lord our God, and the two would-be lions finished the prayer together. It's a silly old story, but I had no idea that that was actually going to play out and become real in the Warsaw Zoo, where the refugees did hide in the lion's cage.
Did you keep finding these connections? Throughout the story, one animal connection after another. A Nazi soldier has this odd, deep affection for insects, which plays a huge role
in the story. Yes. Who would think that an insect collection would save the lives of so many people? But it opened the door, a secret door, into the ghetto and made it possible. Of course, one had to be clever enough to capitalize on that, and Jan was. They were very attuned to every little shred of a possibility. Offering to raise pigs at the zoo was also smart. And then, of course, Jan said he would have to go into the ghetto to collect scraps, as if there were going to be spare scraps in the ghetto. Or on another occasion, he received a pass into the ghetto to be the inspector of parks.
Yeah.
There were no parks in the ghetto. But he managed to find ways to do it so that he could help people.
I wonder about I can't remember his first name. Heck, officer.
Lutz Heck.
Lutz Heck. He's an intriguing character. On one hand, again, a lover of these exotic breeds. His story is really very interesting. And there's a moment that's really terrifying where, on one hand, he saves some of the more exotic animals.
Yes, he does.
On the other hand, there's a hunting party that he brings to the area.
He has a New Year's Eve hunting party at the zoo in which he invites the Nazi elite, who arrive drunken with their rifles, to shoot as many of the remaining caged animals as they like. Absolutely horrifying. And Antonina is inside the villa with her son, trying desperately to distract him. Of course, he hears the gunfire, and he's scared to death. The animals are his friends out there. She doesn't want him to be picturing them being shot. And so she tries to distract him by reading from his favorite book, which is Robinson Crusoe.
It's not working very well.
It's not working very well at all. Lutzek, there are a lot of characters in this story, a lot of very theatrical and crazy characters. And Lutzek was an adventurer.
Yeah.
And a big game hunter, as well as being the director of the Berlin Zoo and the top Nazi zoologist who desperately wanted to ingratiate himself with the Third Reich. And so he was willing to do whatever had to be done to do that. And he and Goering and Hitler decided that after the war, the Nazi elite would require pure Aryan horses to ride and pure Aryan animals to hunt. And of course, they would need a mythic landscape in which to do that. And it was that combination that made it possible, ultimately, to save the zoo and through the zoo, the human beings.
There's a moment in that story, sort of at the end, when Antonina is trying to process what had happened after that butchery of that hunting party. And she says, how many humans will die like this in the coming months?
Yes. And it also strikes her as very ironic and sad that in her experience, animals can be tamed and lose their wild nature pretty quickly in just a couple of months. And yet she witnesses humans becoming more savage than any of the animals she's known.
They're devolving in some ways.
Yes, exactly.
I wonder what it was like for you when you went to Poland to sort of retrace Antonina's steps, because you did. And I wonder, what was the villa like? I mean, it was nothing more than a shell, I guess, by the end of the war. But the villa where she lived, where all this menagerie was happening.
You know, even as you're asking me that, I'm there. When I went to the Warsaw Zoo, which is a wonderful zoo, now, the director I met, and also I met the new zookeeper's wife.
Wow.
Oh, that was so poignant. the zookeeper gave me the key to the villa, which still stands, and essentially said, go, enjoy. And so I was able to just go in there and commune with Antonina and with all the people who had been there. And I could lie down in the bed in her bedroom. I could stand on her terrace. And because Warsaw was rebuilt after the war in meticulous old town, in meticulous detail, according to Renaissance drawings, I could stand on her balcony and see what she saw. Mm. And I could hear the sounds of the zoo animals the same way she did. And then, of course, when I got back home, I researched, what do the gibbons sound like? What are their duets like exactly? What are the different scent broadcasts that the different animals did? And all of those things that would have surrounded her. But it was thrilling. I was in a state of cold thrill the whole time because I could picture her there. And, for example, the stairs. The stairs remained after the war, and I could picture the pet pig who lived with them skittering down the stairs and the sound that it would have made. In fact, I listened to the sound of footsteps on the stairs because the stairs connected the upstairs, the downstairs, and the basement. And so if you think about it, it was like a musical instrument. Mm. It was kind of hollow area, and it made that sort of sound as people walked up and down it, I noticed. And the varnish that was on the staircase wood, all the different things that a child would have noticed and played with. I could notice, my 11-year-old could play with. And I could retrace her steps through the city. That's exactly what I did. And notice the cobblestones, the different colors of the cobblestones.
You're conjuring smells, though, at this time, too, aren't you? It seems like you...
Also the smells. Yeah. The linden trees were in bloom when I was there. And the linden there give off a kind of narcotic scent. But also there are clouds of bees that are honeying in the trees, and they make a sound, too. So I don't know. People probably thought I was crazy. No crazier than my neighbors do on any given day in my upstate New York home, you know, when they see me just standing there and listening, you know, or shaking hands with the snowy trees so that the snow will fall on me and doing things like that. But you can just stand and listen, just stand and smell and be in her world because that's what she did.
I want to ask you about there's a story, and I don't know how much actually we should even say about it, but it's – it's a cruel joke.
Oh, yeah.
That soldiers play on Riche.
Well, suffice to say that there are many near misses.
Yeah.
That the brain of a young child in wartime can only be warped in different ways, and that he had a lot of his pets killed, dragged off, and there were occasions when he was almost dragged off himself. Many horrifying times for his mother, for him. And, of course, his father disappeared every day to work, to the underground. He never knew if he was going to come home alive. And so he would insist on staying home well past curfew and so on, staying awake, rather, so that he could be sure that everybody got home safe. How do kids feel safe in wartime? Not so easy.
Well, and there's this moment when the soldiers, they behave in a pretty despicable way. But then at this time, Antonina is pregnant.
Yes.
And they offer her a seat.
This is the same paradoxical nature that we were talking about earlier when it came to animals and to nature.
Yeah.
On the one hand, they don't mind letting her think that her son is dead, virtually killed in front of her eyes. But on the other, they say, oh, you must be, you know, you must be feeling
You're pregnant, you should sit down
over here and so on.
And she's trying to figure it out. She can't, she's trying to sort of get a hold of how it is that.
And what she concludes is that pure evil must not really exist. What I conclude is that human beings are very contradictory beings and that we're capable of feeling many extremes of emotion, that nobody is absolutely good or absolutely bad, that on any given day the same person can be saint-like or have satanic thoughts anyway, that the human psyche is much more complex than we like to think.
Let me ask you finally, Antonina didn't live to see the reemergence of the zoo. Do you regret that? I mean, was that a sort of a sad moment because she always knew it would reemerge someday.
Yes, well, I think so. And so when I was at the zoo, I adopted a cheetah because I thought she would have liked that. She was really nuts about the lynx kittens
and polka dots
and polka dots. Yeah. Exactly, that was it. She loved polka dot dresses, anything polka dotted. And, you know, some zoos have what they call adoption programs. And so you support the animal and you get to be the godmother. And so I have a goddaughter named Tosca, a speckled one. I have a human one named Zoe, too, but I have a speckled one named Tosca. And I did that for Antonina. And I think there will be other good works that I will find to do on her behalf.
Diane Ackerman. Her book is called The Zookeeper's Wife. It's the basis for a new film, which opens on Friday at the Broadway Center Cinemas in Salt Lake City. For showtimes there and other theaters along the Wasatch Front, you can go to our website, KUER.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.